ask questions about in their academic careers. We bring them together with fans so that you guys can ask them questions and they can hopefully answer all those burning questions you have about, you know, why does Kusanagi even ask if she's the same person in a different ghost body, so on and so forth. Right? The Comics and Popular Arts Conference does a variety of programming across Dragon Con. We present in a variety of tracks. If you have a pamphlet that has our schedule of presentations, our next presentation in the anime track is tomorrow at 7 p.m., where we will be talking about the philosophical themes in Madoka Magica and Cowboy Bebop. It's a really interesting panel. I'm excited for it. But without further ado, we've got Damian Williams from Kennesaw State University, Carl Dull, who's an independent scholar, and Michael Bogaisky, who is also an independent scholar. So the way this is going to work is each one of them will give a brief explanation of how they're coming at virtual reality in Japanese anime, and then we're going to open it up to questions. Oh, wait, yeah. I'm your moderator, Don Flowers, not just some random dude up here talking to you. All right, so who wants to go first?
Mike does.
Mike.
All right.
Mike's got the business.
You can or I can.
I'll start.
You want to start?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, everybody. My name is Michael. What?
How's our mics?
Mics? Michael? Oh, can you hear me? Is that okay?
Sweet. Test.
A little better.
Hello, everybody. How are you doing today?
Everybody.
Can you hear in the back? All right, good.
Okay, that's what I was looking for. I'm here to talk about them virtual reality monsters and Digimans. I'm going to talk about my Animu collection and get all up in this. But in all seriousness, I am interested in virtual reality anime. In the terms of becoming, being, and seeming to be something. I believe there's a big difference in anime when you get from seeming to be something to being something. In this, I'm looking mostly at Sword Art Online, Log Horizon, and Excel World. For you who aren't aware, Excel World and Sword Art Online both have a shared universe, with Excel World coming out several years beforehand, but being further in the future for Sword Art Online. So if you haven't watched Excel World yet, go do it. And other than that, I'm going to talk about Log Horizon. So, do you want me to do a synopsis or just go? Okay. So the seeming to be something and being something, I think, is a really common trend you see in a lot of anime, not just virtual reality ones. But I feel like over the last 4 years or so, you've had a lot in the virtual reality genre where you've had the differences between seeming and being really elucidated. That's sort of a line joke. Thank you. got bad audience. You're supposed to laugh at my bad jokes, jeez.
Yes, blame the audience for all of our problems.
Yeah, that's what I'm here to do. But, okay, for the difference of what it seems to be something and actually being something, I think just as I offer a really good upfront example of this. So as when we were asking earlier who had seen Log Horizon, do you all remember the beginning of it? They come in, level 90, a bunch of truly strong MMO players, and they promptly proceed to get their butt kicked by a bunch of level 20 like rats or something like that right outside the city. Because they're all sitting there thinking that they are, of course, level 90 bosses, and realize that they don't know how to actually do anything. at one point, they're flailing with their weapons. They're screaming out the attack names, hoping that it'll actually do something. because, you know, when you're used to going... Or if you're a warlock and WoW, you just face roll. But, it works. It really does. So the difference there is that they seemed to be what they were. You have a bunch of characters who are in reality, of course, just normal people who are stuck, pulled into the game, and they are seeming to be something. By all apparent observations, they are equipped with the best gear. They're all level 90. They're all very strong. But they're not actually the game characters. As opposed to, say, the latter half of Log Horizon, Season 2 particularly, where they're going into the more advanced raids, and you actually see them actually as the character. And which is kind of the rough example there. Sword Art Online does this as well, the difference from seeming to being. You see it, it's less pronounced because at the beginning everyone is new to Sword Art Online, with the exception of the beaters who went through the beta for it. And, you know, so you have Kirito and the other beaters who actually know what they're doing and are running straight to, you know, go level up in the easy places and get all the EXPs. But the reality there is that from seeming to being there is a far larger arc than what you had as it was really put in Log Horizon. In Log Horizon, it was right up in front of you. Strong guys can't beat level 1 mobs. Couldn't do it. In Sword Art Online, you have characters who... The line between seeming and being was a lot thinner there. Because they seemed to be in a game, but they started off as level 1. They kind of grew into it. Whereas in Log Horizon, you had a gap, and they were trying to catch up to it. This really came about for seeming and being also when Kirito unlocked, spoilers, dual wielding. Sorry, there's going to be spoiler talk in this chat, so if you haven't seen these yet, just, you know, earmuffs it up. And so, and you had that moment where it was, he unlocked dual wielding due to the ability to have be the quickest or highest agility in Sword Art. And it was another situation where seeming and being collided. Before, he just seemed to be preternaturally fast. But actually, when it was acknowledged and, you know, became canonical in the game, so to speak, when he hit that moment from seeing to being. The difference in reasons why seeming and being are important is because on some level, not just in virtual reality, we all interact in the same nature of seeming and being. Who's ever heard the phrase, fake it till you make it? Yeah. There you go. That's seeming and being. You seem to be something, you're faking it, until eventually you aren't faking it anymore and you are something. That's kind of what it means for seeming and being. In virtual reality, seeming and being is the nature of the game we're playing. We seem to be something. We are seeming to be something. And really, given our current technology, we really can't ever really become something. But you can bridge that divide. For seeming and being in real life, though, it is something that we commit to and interact with every day. Just talking about reinventing yourself in some way, or even getting more into something. Seeming and being is a really important thing. And the fact that you are having it bridged out now in anime and in a really accessible way for... really a successful way for, like, having it demonstrated there in virtual reality, I think is a really important thing, especially in terms of media, where seeming and being has always been present, but it's never quite been quite done like that in virtual reality, at least in anime, except for, you know, all the major ones, like Ghost in the Shell.
Excellent segue. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yes?
Yeah.
Go on.
Okay. All right. So, I might try standing. Yeah. I'm going to see if I can do this. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Is that good? All right. So my name's Carl. And thank you all for being here. This is really exciting. It's just really, really, it's really exciting to see everyone here, to see a full room of people who just really love anime and want to talk about this stuff, and just don't mind hanging out and seeing where the conversation leads. So again, just thank you all for being here, because we couldn't get a chance to do this without you all. So it's awesome. Virtual reality and anime, I I started watching this stuff before we knew how to pronounce these things correctly, so I apologize. Ghost in the Shell was one of the first things I saw, and it was amazing. There was some other stuff I saw earlier, but this was like one of the early ones, and it really hit a chord just because it was so detailed, it was so in-depth. There was so much thought packed into it's not even 2 hours. It's like a 1 hour and 20 minute movie. It's like 80 minutes. It's ridiculous, like how much detail and thought and action actually is just in this one film. I'm going to be talking mostly about the 1995 first movie, right? So hopefully, how many guys have seen that one again? The very first one? Awesome. If you haven't, it's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. It's pretty accessible. It feels a little slow at some points, but then you watch through and it's really building on itself very nicely. Where we're coming at with this movie and what I wanted to talk about in particular was the idea of consciousness. And really like what it means to be conscious. And I mean what does it mean to be aware of yourself? What does it mean to have a concept? What does it mean to have a concept of myself that lasts through time? Right? What does it mean for me to have a sense of identity, especially in a world where our identities are so permeable and so changing? And we see this a little bit now with social media, right? We see this with social media where we have different presentations of ourselves, and people react to that differently. There are different interactions that occur with our different representations of ourselves in different environments. That gets confusing enough. I mean, like, if you've ever been on an argument on Facebook, and you're like, no, wait, what is this? That's not what I meant to do. No. Or if you ever said something on Twitter, and you're like, oh, dear God, why that? You know? There's people who are talking now about the right to forget, right? So this is actually a thing now. So people are talking about, there's European legislation that talks about having the right to be forgotten, because, lo and behold, you said something, or someone said something dumb on the internet, and it would be really, really nice if that would just eventually just be forgotten eventually someday. In Ghost in the Shell, this pushes things to the limit. This is such a cool concept. It's a great movie because it pushes things to the absolute limit. The main character, Major Motoko Kusanagi, has been a cyborg more or less from birth. She has, and you get into this later with Arise, but as a young child, she was already put into some kind of cyborg or artificial life situation. Her brain was intact, and then she was then put in progressively larger bodies as she matured. This more than anything else I can think of, does a great job of taking. So how many of you guys have ever had to suffer through an intro philosophy class? Yeah? been there with you. And you always get to Descartes, and they're like, well, what if you're just a brain in a vat, right? What if your brain just got taken out of your skull and stuck into a vat and nothing is true? Ghost in the Shell puts us in that situation. I don't want to get stuck into like what's real versus what isn't real, because, and they make this point in the film, at one point Batu says, he says, look, even hallucinations, dreams, fantasy, reality, all of it is real somehow. All of this was somehow an experience that was real to that person. What we get instead is in Ghost in the Shell, we get these questions of what does it mean? What does it mean to me when I'm in this body that can change? What does it mean when I'm in this, when I have this mind, and this mind can be put in different places? Like my consciousness can be in different places. What does it mean when I have a different sense of myself? When you know, who I think I am is not who I am, or when that's changing? And she goes through this transformation. She's wrestling with what it means to be who she is, and then she's wrestling with what it means to be what she's going to become. And she has this encounter with the puppet master that leads to this kind of transcendent, you know, just this transformation, this big transformation. But there's an event that starts really, the event that kind of starts this all rolling in the movie is they run into this guy, this garbage man. They're trying to figure out who's doing the ghost hacking, right? They're trying to figure out who's hacking into people's memories and fiddling with government officials, right? And so they trace this to a garbage man who's doing phone hacks, and he's doing as he goes along on the line, right? And they chase him down, they catch him, and then they catch the guy that hooked him up with all of this. And they find out that not only the garbage man, but his contact have both been hacked, right? Right, they've both been hacked. And the garbage man thinks that he's absolutely convinced that he's trying to get in touch with his kids, right? And he's trying to hack in to his wife's memories, I think, if I remember correctly, and he says he's just trying to figure out what his wife is doing. He wants to see his kids. He hasn't seen them in like 10 years. And it's all false. Like, it's all completely false. They find out this is a completely fake memory that was put into his brain, and he's heartbroken. Like, he breaks down in tears, and they're doing the interrogation. They have to ask him repeatedly. It's like, do you remember? Like, we've been to your apartment. We've been to your apartment. There's no one there. It's just you, right? It's just a bachelor pad. And then he takes this picture out that he was showing his coworker. He's like, look, it's my little girl. It's my little angel. And you see the picture for the first time, and it's just him with a dog, right? And there's a basset hound that makes these recurring appearances in the movie, by the way. It's a little funny. And so, and he's devastated. And then they're looking at him through the mirror, looking at him through the police mirror, and they're like, this is, you know, this poor guy, right? We can't get rid of these memories. They're with you. And then this kind of starts Motoko. Motoko then kind of goes on this introspective turn, and there's this diving scene. This diving scene is fantastic. It's really, really neat. It's very artistic. And there's a lot going on here. There's not a lot of dialogue at first, but it shows her like rising through the ocean, and then she's kind of confronting. There's this great image where she's rising to the surface. And at one point in the film, she says she's rising. When she dives, she feels like she gets closer to the surface, and she feels like she's turning into someone else. And the reason that I wanted to bring all this, the reason I want to bring all this together is that when you start looking at yourself, and we do this through reflection, right? We do this either through literal reflection, like literally reflecting in a mirror. We look at ourselves when we're getting ready in the morning, right? We look at ourselves when we're getting ready to go out. But we also do this through self-reflection, right? Through thinking about ourselves, through thinking about our past and our history. And so this diving scene is very much visualizing that process of reflection. And she's coming up to the surface, and she sees herself. She sees herself in the reflection, and then it gets all blurry, right? And this is when you look too closely at something. I think this is actually very similar to what happens when you look too closely at something. All of a sudden, it loses focus, right? So we like, you know, when you're looking in the mirror and you're looking at yourself, and you're like, I look good. This is good. I look great. I like this. And you get closer, and you're like, wait a minute. Like, what are these? You know, I've got like a little blemish here. I've got a little pore. And then you start looking at yourself, and you're like, I'm weird. Like you're like the face, the human, what's going on with the human face? This is so weird, right? And then you're just like, who am I?
I'm beautiful, that's what. Well.
If you're Mike, then you don't have that problem, right?
No.
And I think, so part of what my argument here with this movie, with Ghost in the Shell, is even though this is all done in virtual reality, some of this questioning, I think, is very, very natural for us to feel as well. You know, when we look at ourselves and we ask, you know, who am I? Who am I becoming? Right? Who am I trying to be? Not like in a bad sense, but like, what are the things that I'm worried about? What is my job wanting me to do? What, I'm going to a new school now. What am I supposed to be learning? And as you go through this process, you change. And your image of yourself changes, and it's not clear all the time. It's not distinct. It's blurry, and we don't know what we're going to become. And this is a big thing that we get to in this movie, is that as they chase down the puppet master, right, they chase down the puppet master, and she finds out that he really, really wants to talk to her, because they've got this kind of relationship where they both, you know, he's a purely digital entity, and she has lived almost her entire life in some kind of cybernetic mode, and she doesn't know what she's going to become. So when they merge, or when they get together, she doesn't know what's going to happen. And he says, one of the points that he makes, the puppet master makes, is this is part of life. He says, if you're not able to change, if you're not able to adapt, this is part of life, and this is what's going to happen. And if you get too specialized, it's just like what happens for a species. Things die. So if you as a person don't change, and if your identity gets fixed, then you won't be able to adapt to new situations. So that's kind of how I was coming from the movie. And there's tons more that we could talk about, but I think it was just one of the fantastic things about the film, and I think it's one of the neat things that you get through that film and through that whole series. So that's what I wanted to share with you all, and thanks very much. So I'm going to pass it on to Damien.
I'm also going to stand. I can see everybody in the back.
It's nice, yeah.
It is very nice.
Yeah.
Hi, again, I'm Damien Williams. I'm going to be approaching this conversation from a kind of a similar space from both of my colleagues up here, because what I want to talk about is the nature of reality as presented through virtual reality, specifically looking at Serial Experiments Lane, and the fact of watching something that we imbue with ourselves and we give all of this power over our lives, watching how it in turn becomes real for us, watching what that does to our sense of reality, both in a kind of metaphorical sense, but also in a very literal sense, and seeing the creation of reality through the experience of the digital. One of the things that's been happening a lot, especially in the late 20th and early 21st century, is that we see a lot of the drive to make visions of the future that we had thought we would get actually come into reality. And one of the things that we've been trying for the longest time is actually virtual or augmented reality. This, you know, VR world that is like this world, but not this world, that we can have all of this extra power, all of these capabilities, and making those things be the world in which we live. Serial Experiments Lane touches on this well before we actually manage to, you know, see it in our everyday lives, and it creates the sense of a world wherein not only do we create this world where we have more power, but the power we exercise in that world has direct and immediate effect on the quote-unquote real world. And there's this back-and-forth interplay between the so-called virtual world and the so-called real. So I want to talk about how that mirrors a lot of what we deal with in our everyday lives and what it is that we talk about when we say that, oh, it's just the internet or it's just virtual reality. It's not, somehow we think of it as not quite real, even while clinging to it as real. And at the same time, we seek to bring those elements by technological means to this actual physical real world. That's really all I've got so far as preliminaries go. I want to get this conversation started. So, thank you.
All right, so we have plenty of time for questions. If you got them, raise your hands. You guys want to self-moderate, or you want me to? I'll start pointing.
So, as far as Ghost in the Shell goes, I don't recall how much of this is talked about in the original movie and how much of it's talked about in the standalone complex in Second Wave, but there's often seems like, at least within the society in Japan, they're talking about how people have ghosts, and so they're real, and it's basically their soul, and machines don't have ghosts, so we can treat them entirely differently. And then you have the Pachikomas that they're starting to debate whether or not they're sort of spontaneously developing ghosts by having been real people. I think it's interesting how they sort of artificially created this idea of a soul that they're slowly starting to realize those lines don't exist, or at least are very clear. And I'm wondering, I know in Western culture we have this very solid sort of Abrahamic-based idea of soul as something for itself. And I don't know the philosophy of use as well, so I don't know how much of that is, of where the origin culturally of that idea is.
Oh, wait, I think they're all looking at me because...
Well,
I think they all want to talk.
That is what we do. But at the
you
same time...
Pick one.
Yeah.
Pick your favorite.
Mike, we'll start with you.
Yes! To talk about culturally and the spirit and soul in Japan in particular, I'm a quasi-Japan scholar as well, and I used to live in Japan as well. It comes back to the one of the aboriginal beliefs of Japan, the Shinto religion, for which everything has a spirit. You have bridges with spirits, and buildings with spirits, and trees with spirits. Everything, in fact, has a spirit. So when you're talking about ideas that are inherent to Japan, it's very difficult to separate out Shinto beliefs from other beliefs. There's this great saying, I think it is, that you can wear many hats through your life in Japan, and you can be born a Shinto and live as a Buddhist and die as a Christian or something like that. Like, you can really go the full gamut of religious experience there. But it's to the point that the Shinto beliefs and Shinto religion is pretty much inherent in the society. I would say it, from my experience living there, you'd almost have to be more active in rejecting Shinto than simply just accepting it and it being there. And I think as the notion of a soul or a spirit, that's kind of where that comes in. I think is that initial Shinto, the base of the Shinto religion is that everything has a spirit, and even items after, what is it, 99 years?
Yeah.
After 99 years, an item gains a soul. It has that Shinto spirit to it. So even artificial objects, you have that, which is why there's a great deal of trouble that goes into rebuilding, say, Shinto temples in Japan. For which don't use metal nails. And you have these elaborately constructed large temples for which are fitted together solely for wood. There are certain trees which have to be harvested in a certain way, facing a certain direction, to keep the nature of the spirit of the temple the same.
Yeah. Sorry to jump in, but that actually, something that touches on something that shows up in a lot of the various things that we're talking about, and especially in Ghost in the Shell. There's this concept in philosophy, is the ship of Theseus. It's the idea of when you replace something on a thing, is that thing still itself? If I replace the door of a temple, is it still the same temple? This is Japan's way of making sure that yes, it is. Because the West doesn't really have a solid answer for this. Like, we muddle through this, like, very, very ham-handedly, and we're like, well, I guess, I mean, it's got the same name, and we think of it the same, so maybe, I guess, it's the same. No, and in Japan, no, we did everything right, so it's the same temple. There's rules. So, that's actually, I had forgotten about that until you mentioned that the reconstruction of Shinto temples actually solves the Ship of Theseus problem, like, entirely.
Well, that brings up an interesting point, though. I mean, if you look at Western logic, mathematics, it's all about based on proofs and what have you. So really, it sounds like this whole conversation isn't about are you the same person, but are you pre-programmed? Because something I came up with back when I was in college was, so just before The Matrix came out, was I was talking to a friend in the same scenario, pulling a brain out of a box and wiring it up to a bunch of systems. And I came up with a simple phrase that says, our will is not our own, it's merely a reaction to our senses. But I still believe in free will, and that's because religion. But if you think about it, if you were able to control every single input into a person, you could essentially make them believe whatever you want them to believe. So then it comes down to, well, do we actually have a will, or is it based off random chance? So if you're talking about are you the same person or not, I think then you're starting to blur the lines of, well, are we talking about virtual reality, or are we talking about, are we really just programs that just happen to be biologic?
Yeah, I think you hit this is a really good point. One of the things that's really nice about some of the Eastern perspectives, this is where I use appeal to Buddhism as a way to kind of talk about this issue. And some of the Buddhist philosophy walks what they call like a middle path in this sense. So on the one hand, you know, so the question is, are we entirely free? You know, is our will entirely free to be directed however we so choose, or are we entirely determined mechanistically by our environment, so that whatever we do, even if we think that we're free, is already predetermined, right? And one of the things that I like about the Buddhist idea of the self, and you see this recur actually in a lot of in anime, and you see some Buddhist themes coming in, but there's an idea of the conditioned self. So we don't, or conditioned freedom, and the idea is that we are constituted through various elements in our environment, right? We're constituted through matter, emotion, sensation, consciousness, and volition, which is kind of the desire and pursuit of attainment of goals, and that all contributes to a sense of self that is itself also an aggregate. And so there is no one single permanent stable self, right? This sense of selfhood, but it's changing. It's a dynamic, and they talk about choice being something as choice within sets of possibilities, or possibilities within constraints, and I think it's kind of a nice middle ground. So that's one perspective, and I think that, yeah, I'm not sure where to go with that, but, yeah.
In the back? Yeah, you.
Put your
hand up.
No, her.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, so when it comes to no gain, no life, I've heard, like, a lot of people really enjoy it there, or some people have the opposite of it because of how it was, like, the introvert, staying in the house, and a lot of people find similarities with that. Which is like, they were in another reality, and you go to yourself in something that's like, not real necessarily, which I'm sure like a lot of people in anime and gamers can relate to. But do you think that's a problem, because people say like, well, you shouldn't be that introvert. Like, people like to a gamer, they want you to become more sociable, but I don't think it's necessarily a problem if you don't have any issues with, being by yourself. I mean, maybe not saying something at home all the time, and trying to blur the line between a game and real life. But I think like it's okay to engross yourself fully in something that may not be reality.
Which one of you wants to grab it first, Damien?
I mean, I think that ultimately there is there's got to be some kind of delineation. There's got to be a difference somewhere between where we say, what is healthy for the person and what's healthy for how we want to try to build a society. We got rules for how to build a society, and we say people need to go out and work with each other and build stuff together. But is that going to work for everybody? Is that going to be the same thing that makes a life worth living for every person? No, there are 7 billion people on the planet, and not every mode of living is going to work the same for everybody. Some people are going to want to stay inside more often. Some people are going to want to build a community entirely online. I mean, I know people that spend more time in, WoW, and somehow still Second Life, and, make a life in there, and have, economies and commerce and, culture in that realm that means more to them than anything they've been able to find in the world thus far, in the quote-unquote real world thus far. I'm not going to say that that's my choice. That's not how I would have chosen to go about, but that's not me,
I think we see this issue also in the history of literature. If you look at Emily Dickinson, I think she spent most of her life as a recluse, and then most of her work was then published posthumously. Thoreau spent 2 years living deliberately in the woods because he wanted to get away from everyone and see what it felt like to live every single day deliberately and intentionally with raw experience. I think there's an interesting point in Sword Art Online. And I think it's in the second season of this, when they realize that they're interacting, I think Kirito's interacting with people who are not Sword Art Online survivors, and he's like, oh wait, I have to calm down a little bit, right?
Yeah,
and maybe you, I don't know if Mike wants to say a little bit more about that, but I remember that one point, and I think a lot of it comes down to, it's like, what kind of relationships do you have, and what kind of relationships do you want to nurture and build? Like, what kind of relationships do you want it to grow? And you can do this through either online activity or offline activity.
I'm going to premise this with the statement that I'm a recovering World of Warcraft player. And I am unfortunately also spending way too many days playing Destiny right now, which is probably the next worst thing after World of Warcraft for me. So the no game, no life thing, I understand, because I have invested more time than I'm willing to admit, and I'm not going to do a slash played anymore to see what Anaheim actually is. In terms of, building, I'm going to use Destiny as an example here, so please bear with me. A key phrase right now in Destiny is called building the community. And for a game that is played online by yourself or with others, which generally involves you sitting on a couch by yourself because there's no split screen, effectively playing by yourself no matter what. The building a community, communities arise when people get together. And for our society to build a community involves interaction outside of the game. But communities are also things we create inside games. And while I, will not endorse the neat lifestyle and, living at home, playing games all the time and not going out and doing things, because I like getting out and doing things, I also spend a lot of time on my couch playing Destiny. And in doing so, I'm playing with people, and I'm interacting with others, and I'm helping to build a community, an ongoing community in a game. So what it means to say no game, no life, how you choose to get behind that is up to you. I think, for me, building communities is essential. And be it with playing with different people in games, or going out and coming to cons and meeting everybody here, we're building a community. And I think that's important, too.
So I'm going to abuse moderator privilege and ask a question. So in Sword Art Online and Log Horizon and Ghost in the Shell and even Lane, the line between virtual reality and actual reality gets blurred. It, at least in Sword Art Online and Log Horizon, the line disappears completely. So at least from your perspectives, what's the difference between virtual reality and actual reality as like represented in these anime?
I'm going to jump in on that one because I wanted to, Mike, what you were saying just now was actually making me think about exactly that in Lane. Lane, at the idea of the no game, no life mode in Lane takes one of the main story arcs. And you have these people who are living their entire life trying to, like their quote-unquote real world physical lives, trying to unlock achievements, basically, in the games that they're playing. And they have to be simultaneously hooked into the virtual and the quote-unquote real in order to do it. So yeah, these lines get blurred. And I think that what actually ends up happening in Lane is that even though this is used as like a way to talk about, well, look at what happens when people immerse themselves in these fake worlds, these fake realities, they get lost, and what matters, these connections, these communities get lost. I think that, in a sense, and once again, spoilers, Lane, at the end of it, that's exactly what Lane does. She erases the boundary completely between the virtual, the wired, and the physical real world. She basically folds them completely into each other in a way that makes them more stable and sustainable off of each other. So there's not this disconnect where we're thinking that they have to be different things somehow. We just live and we experience them both.
Mike?
I'm going to ask the really annoying thing. Can you just repeat your question one more time? So I don't want to like tangentially go off somewhere else.
Oh, what's the difference between the virtual world and the real world, if any, in Sword Art Online, Log Horizon, Lane, Ghost in the Shell, the anime that we've been talking about?
Let's talk about Mother's Rosario. If, all right, if wow. if you haven't seen the end of the second season of Sword Art Online entitled Mother's Rosario, you're missing out. It is probably the best storytelling that that show has had for the entire run. For what is real and what is not, I dare you to tell me. Okay, first off, does anybody remember what the girl's name was?
Yeah. Which one?
Yuki? Thank you.
Yeah.
I dare...
Yeah. Remember they had the
Yeah.
Ah,
gotcha.
Yeah.
Thank you. I dare you to tell me that what Yuki was living wasn't real.
That was the point I wanted to ask.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Here you have a girl, I will spoil this right now, so earmuffs if you really don't want to hear about Mother's Rosario, the ending of Sword Art Online. Yuki is a girl who is deathly ill and is dying, and they are using virtual reality as a mode of treatment for her to essentially, rather than, you know, drug someone up for their last days, she's living entirely in the virtual world. So what you have with Yuki is a person who is the essential same experience that Kirito and Asuna and every SAO player has, who are literally, at one point even Kirito comments that this is a person who is in the game as much or more than he is, or has been at that point. So for Yuki, I would not make a differentiation of what is real and not. If you want to talk strictly in terms of physical bodies, yes. But the emotion and the experience of what makes us us, I don't think there's a distinction there for what's real or not.
Carl?
I think this points to a question that we really need to ask, which is, it's not so much the difference between what is real and what isn't, because I think, you know, what we've seen in all of these shows is that what we call virtual, conventional, has very real repercussions. Very, very, very real repercussions or very real consequences.
Yeah.
And we see this now in our current time as well, in the information age, where things that happen digitally or online have incredibly real consequences. This is, you know, in terms of serious issues, this is a big issue with, like, personal information and personal data, security. And there's big questions going on about what's the extent that we need to be policing personal information, or what's the extent that governments have the right to, to invade all of this information, right? So these are big questions, and this is all happening digitally. It's happening invisibly, and yet it's having big consequences. You know, less seriously, like I said, it goes back to there's stuff you post on Twitter, and you're like, ooh, I wish I hadn't done that. You know, so I think the question is what is meaningful? I think the question is what is meaningful? Because everything that we experience is real to some degree. It has some real element to it. There's no magic world of what's real and what isn't anymore. You know, everything we experience somehow, you know, is important to human experience, and we have to figure out what that means and where we want that to take us.
You in the back?
Let me take you guys to stand because I can't really see you. But so it seems like, you know, what we've been sort of tracing around and around is that, you know, our conception of the real is consensual, and therefore, you know, what one group calls real, another group calls fake, et cetera, et cetera. And you have, you know, I think the really important part of, you know, all of the anime that we've been talking about, all of, you know, in basically any virtual reality story, is when that divide breaks down and we sort of recognize that what we considered virtual, which is to say entirely made up of science and discourse, is in fact our reality, and that's how life functions. today. And I was actually wondering where that leaves seeming versus being, if we agree that essentially what you seem and what you claim to be become a reality if it's widely agreed upon. And I'm sort of, you know, I hate to be the postmodernist in the room who's like, it's all signs and none of it means anything.
But, meaningless signs.
At the same time, you know, there's still some kernel of something that, you know, each of these properties seems to want to hold on to. For Ghost in the Shell, it's some kind of affect that, you know, makes Krishnagi multiple. You know, for whatever else it may be, it's, you know, often ideas about health and the body and what is right and normative. And so is that simply a misconception? Or is that sort of a misguided desire for something to hold on to? And
one question at a time.
Yes,
that's like a gigantic, complicated question.
That is a big question. Yeah.
That's a good postmodernist question.
Yeah,
that's a big question.
I'll again abuse my moderator privilege and answer the first question he asked.
Okay. Where does it leave seeming and being? Seeming and being is a process, and it's not a state in which you reach. So it's a process. As with all processes, it's ongoing. The key with seeming and being, and with being a person, is that you're malleable. You change. That's how the process works with seeming and being, is you change from one thing to another. However, the perceptions of what it is for seeming and being when you're acting to do something changes as well. As a person, you are inherently fungible. What you have in mind never actually stays in mind for what you want to be. So when I talk about seeming and being, it's important to realize that it's a process thing. And ideally, in a wonderful, real world that probably doesn't exist, it's a ameliorative process. It's a process in which you improve as you go. Now, as I can attest, having lived a really weird life and done some things I probably shouldn't have done, it's not always a ameliorative process. What you are and what you end up isn't always a good thing. Ideally, it should be. It should improve. For seeming and being, like I said, I'm going to back to you, it's a process. So the bridging that gap between seeming and being and virtual reality and things like that, I think there's always room for it. Because even in virtual reality, it's still a reality in which you are changing. I think just the very nature of people is that change. So I think you can't... I don't know if you can really escape that seeming and being process. I think you can reach a point in which maybe you're happy with the person you are, and you're not trying to seem to be something else. But I'm not sure if I buy that. I'm not sure if I'd invest in that as an idea, that there's an end to that. Did that answer your question, or did I just kind of ramble off into nothingness?
No.
Okay,
so we had two people with questions. You had your hand up, like, forever.
Okay. Now, hopefully I won't repeat some of what he was talking about, but I just, you know, kind of give you the kind of case of where I'm from. I'm a computer graphics engineer. I do a lot of this stuff a lot of this stuff that you probably heard about. Interactive with almost on a daily basis, and for about the past year and a half, I've got the Oculus Rift, I've dealt with HTC system, and PlayStation's Project Morpheus, And I look back upon Serial Experiments Lane, and yes, to a certain degree, Ghost in the Shell. And I haven't seen too much of what he has, but I'm definitely going to go look at it. And I can't help but to see there's some parallels of what the promise is of what some of the stuff that I am working on, and what the fate of it might be in some of these certain kind of animes. And I was wondering if that's something like a real issue in as far as the technology becoming the, you know, the science fiction becoming the science real, and how we're going to be prepared for it. Because I think, you know, they're talking about for some of this stuff as early as Christmas, you know, releasing it. And I think it's been, and hope, you know, in some ways, I hope it becomes a changing experience for a lot of people. And in other ways, I kind of fear.
Carl, weren't you talking about Oculus Rift earlier?
Yes.
With Ghost in the Shell?
Yes. So thank you very much. It's an excellent question. I think I wish we had much more time to be able to sit down and talk about some of the particular things that you've probably seen and worked on. One of the things that I think is interesting about Oculus Rift right now is, so there's a slight difference between things like Oculus Rift and what we're seeing in some of the anime that we're talking about. It's on a functional level at the moment, and I think ultimately that's going to be overcome. So my understanding of Oculus Rift at the moment is, and what we're doing with some of the VR technology, is instead of plugging directly into the brain, we are basically putting two iPhones right up in front of your face. And that's only a functional difference. That's really only a functional difference. I think that your point is really well made, which is that when we're talking about the kind of experiences that we're getting into, because they're aiming for full immersion experience.
Yeah, they're talking about, looking at a discussion this March over at the development conference, there was a talk about, okay, now what would be about haptic sense.
Feelings,
to go out and grasp it.
Yeah.
And if you look at what HTC is doing in VR, what they call Steam VR, that's something that you actually work inside a space, and you can actually walk around the object and supposedly manipulate the object. That's a little, I call them the two maracas, but.
And the point is, and this is where it gets weird, is because we're getting to the point now where it doesn't matter how the technology necessarily works. What matters is that the experience is convincing. And there's been some weird stuff out there already. One of the articles I saw was on this was for the Rift. It was a guillotine simulator. Right? Like, is that not just horrifying? Like, no, I'm not kidding. And so, surprise, the initial reactions were surprise, horrifying, right? Like, people were doing this and they were, like, freaking out because this was the experience of having your head cut off, right? And it was phenomenologically an incredibly disturbing experience, as it should be. I don't know why they did this. Someone said, hey, I want to do it. I have no idea why. But anyway, so
this is why technology groups need philosophers in residence. Let me just say
yes,
that right now.
Yes.
There's a
Star Trek. There's a DS9, I think, where O'Brien is caught. O'Brien is caught, and he's held on a planet where they force him to go through, I think, what is it, 100 years?
Like 1,000
years. Or 1,000 years. Okay, 1,000 years of punishment within the span of, I think, like a couple of minutes, because of VR technology. Ethically, that should raise some flags, right? The people who like waterboarding, I'm not sure should get a hold of VR technology. That might be bad. But then there's also some amazing things that are going on with VR technology. I was just reading an abstract on a piece in the NIH about using VR for stroke rehabilitation. And it's having demonstrably positive results or at least demonstrably more significant results than some of the traditional therapy.
Yeah. All that. One of the things that I think is exciting is, you know, ESD.
Yes. Yes.
Not all that dissimilar from what Yuki was doing at the end of Sword Art Online. You had a question that you've been sitting on for something.
Oh, I just was thinking about so currently in the real world, you know, everyone's running on the internet. Been on the internet before, run into an internet troll, and, you know, they'll say things that in the real life they would have never said. But in the virtual, like, reality worlds we're talking about, you know, Sword Art and Excel Online, you see that these people can, like, develop two personalities, one that they can show to the real world and one that they can't. So sort of like, if you take it, like, my cosplay Death Note, for example, you know, Light has this personality that he shows everyone in general, and then he has this personality, obviously, that's like, you can almost say, obviously, that it's split personality. And I almost think Kirito's a similar way in Sword Art, where, like, in this game, he's like a huge hero, but out of the game, he's, you know, an awkward person. He tries to use the skills he has in the game, and he just doesn't have them. So, I guess sort of the question is, if we did reach a point where, like, the virtual reality was that close, the, what would be, like, the borderline for people that, like, obviously already have these personalities that where they can throw so much aggression into a game or throw so much aggression online compared to, like, how they act in, like, the general population?
Consequences.
The
biggest difference between Log Horizon and Sword Art Online is that in Sword Art Online, there are consequences. Log Horizon doesn't have consequences until they get the planet's worst landlord to come, who promptly buys the place where you can respawn. Or no, sorry, he buys the bank.
No. They lost their memories. You know, if they've died too much, they actually lost their memories.
Wow. They do lose their memories as a consequence, but, like, the actual, in terms of, like, stiff consequences, like, they could go out and kill each other. They'd lose some memories here and there, but they'd otherwise come back. Sword Art, you go and you kill someone, they're dead. At least in early Season 1 Sword Art. I think the difference there is that there are the different kinds of consequences you had. And you had those players also in Sword Art. The red-flagged players who, lest we forget, Kirito is also one. Three, four people he actually ended up killing throughout the course of the series? Lest you forget that part of it. Which he does deal with, actually, in the second half when he's dealing with his PTSD because of it.
Yeah, the second season of Sword Art Online, by the way, is actually, as you would, I would really like to point out, that's almost exclusively about dealing with PTSD. Or not exclusively, but a main theme in the second season is PTSD, and it's incredibly well done.
But I suppose what I'm trying to get at there is the consequences of that virtual world, there has to be the consequences that you have in the real world. You have a very Lord of the Flies situation going on at the beginning of Log Horizon because there's no law. There's nothing there to keep the law, to maintain it. It's in many ways a worse world, I think, than Sword Art was.
So I was just given the 5-minute warning. Does anybody have a really bad... Well...
Yeah, I've gone back when Wayne was something being discussed about Wired and the real world merging, which is something that's like happening in the real world kind of right now. But it seemed like Wayne kind of went back and forth having a very strong opinion about the two being able to merge and that being a good thing, and then kind of like regretting it late in the season, and then kind of in the end it seemed like it got really blurred as to like what the actual good thing to do was when the Masame era was.
Right.
I was kind of trying to follow the director's opinion through this, like, because I figured he would express it through Lane, but it didn't come out very clear.
No.
Is there some kind of, like, explanation, you know?
No.
No, it's just, no.
Ultimately, it's the director of Lane sought to make Lane in order to make an anime that was incomprehensible to Western audiences, and that's something that we should never forget. Like, that was literally one of the primary purposes of Serial Experiments Lane, was to be incomprehensible to Western audiences. Many Western audience members will say that he failed in this, and he will then get really angry and probably say, "Shut up, you failed." And that's a different thing. So basically, it should be take, like, from that point, it should be noted that any interpretation that I do is done from what is, by the director, considered a fundamentally flawed interpretive mode. I will say, that being said, that I think that the point of Lane's back and forth in that is that take note of the moment at which she starts to feel that it's a bad thing, when it affects her, when her life begins to get extraordinarily blurred and her expression of self in the Wired is seen by others as this very controlling, negative, manipulative force. And she starts to say, you know, the Wired and the real world need to be separate. That's not me. That's not me. But the more she comes to recognize that these are aspects of herself, that these are aspects of the world that she is putting into play, that she is merging, that it has to be done in a way that isn't just one person's will, that it can't just be Lane, it can't be, you know, Messerman Erie, it can't be just one person's will exercised over the Wired and the world. It has to be everybody, because it's everybody.
Unfortunately, nature doesn't work that way.
This.
I have a positive aspect to contribute.
I'd let you, but I want to give our panelists time to give some concluding thoughts. So you guys have any concluding thoughts?
You first.
You go first. Okay, sure.
My Carl was voted.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you get what you pay for. I was actually thinking about the consequences issue, and I think we've seen some really interesting movements in that direction already. If anyone play League of Legends, they institute an honor system, and I'm not sure about Dota. Dota may do this too, but I know League of Legends instituted a player behavior and honor system. And they discovered that when you give positive reinforcement and positive social recognition, and again, this is stuff we've known, right? But we're seeing this now in a virtual or in an online arena, that player behavior improved immensely, and they started doing research. And so some of the stuff they've done is actually a huge repository for player behavior interactions online. And they've improved. Actually, it's a really kind of I've actually kind of really enjoyed League of Legends just for the community. It's a fairly enjoyable and haven't run into a whole lot of hate. Occasionally a little bit, but not like when you're just like on Xbox Live and just plug and you're just like, oh my God, what is this? So again, consequences and community and the kind of relationships that you have and that you want to have. And I think all of these films and shows just do a fantastic job with bringing us into that, into these spaces of possibility where we can really push these ideas to the limit.
The hit back on seeming and being in virtual reality, what we have here is that it's key to remember that while we're playing a game, we're all seeming to be something else. And that discussion of no game, no life, and seeming and being here, as we all seem to be something, we're all becoming something. And that virtual reality and virtual world in which you participate and are a part of, even if you're not, you know, we're not to that level of, you know, sword art and things like that yet, we're all still participants in it, in one way or another. And the person you are in your virtual world will affect the person you are in the real world. So if you're that guy who screams into my mic when I play on Xbox Live, I will find you. But no, in all seriousness, like how you act online and how you act in this, you know, soon to be virtual worlds, it's still you acting. There it's not like there's a dual agency thing of you in the real world and you in the virtual world. No, you're the same person still.
And that brings me to my final thought, which is one of the things that we've been kind of skirting is this idea of the merging of the virtual and the real, the blending literally of the two, and the potential for that in our everyday lives. Like I said, that's a dream that we've had for a very long time. Before we had virtual reality, we had the dream time and spirit walking. We've had this idea of real worlds and, you know, something that's other than real, something that's more spiritual, more powerful, more versatile, and wanting to be able to walk the line between those two things. I think that one of the things that we're doing and one of the things that we're seeing is that drive, that urge, technologically realized. And when it gets to the point where we have the technology to, you know, move into the virtual world like we would a new house, to visit a virtual world like we would a town over, and then have conversations and have commerce and have consequences for our actions, that we are going to see a very different but very familiar kind of experience.
All right, so let's give our presenters a round of applause.